Welcome back. This time we take into our hands the 16th chapter in Essays on the Gita, titled Now the Process of Avatarhood, published as The Divine Birth and Divine Works, Part 2, on 15th November 1917. And in that issue of the Arya, The Life Divine led with the chapter titled then, The Ascent and the Downward Eye. Synthesis of Yoga was the second selection, Gnosis and Ananda. Then came the Gita. Well, we find ourselves working primarily in the fourth chapter of the Gita throughout this. And in the traditional way of enumerating the chapters, the title of the fourth chapter in the Bhagavad Gita is Jnana Karma Sannyasa Yoga, the yoga of the renunciation of action in knowledge. So let's begin. We see that the mystery of the divine incarnation in man, the assumption by the Godhead of the human type and the human nature, is, in the view of the Gita, only the other side of the eternal mystery of human birth itself, which is always in its essence, though not in its phenomenal appearance, even such a miraculous assumption. The eternal and universal self of every human being is God. Even his personal self is a part of the Godhead. Mamma eva amshah. Not a fraction or fragment, surely, since we cannot think of God as broken up into little pieces, but a partial consciousness of the one consciousness, a partial power of the one power, a partial enjoyment of world being by the one and universal delight of being. And therefore in manifestation, or as we say in nature, a limited and finite being of the one infinite and illimitable being. So this illimitable being, whose nature is consciousness and whose experience is delight, is again in later Vedanta, Satchit Ananda, but it would wait about 1,000 years before being given that terminology. Mamma eva amshah, that's chapter 15, shloka 7. And this idea of oneness is key to an understanding of Vedanta. There is nothing more a signature of its teaching than this unambiguous all-inclusivity. Whether we're reading the Brihadaranyaka, the Chandogya, the Isha, Katha, Mundaka, Mandukya, whichever Upanishad you pick up, it is this Upanishadic vision which forms the basis of Vedanta, and it sings of oneness. It's true, this idea of a personality which includes all the vast essence of being is not something brought out in strict terms in the Upanishads. But the Shvetashvatara Upanishad hints at it. And that teaching adumbrated there is made explicit when we get to the Gita, a continuation of the Vedantic stream. So oneness of being, but not simply existence, but an existent. Not simply impersonality, but a personality which includes impersonality, or a reality that exceeds both personality and impersonality. So again, one consciousness, one power, one delight, all in one being. So, Satchit Ananda, an idea in theistic Vedanta, we continue. The stamp of that limitation, the individual, as opposed to the vastness of this true being, which is illimitable, the stamp of that limitation is an ignorance by which he forgets not only the Godhead from which he came forth, but the Godhead which is always within him, there living in the secret heart of his own nature, there burning like a veiled fire on the inner altar in his own temple house of human consciousness. An ignorance by which he forgets. And if we go to the Latin, ignorare, not to know, from in, not, and gnonescere, to know, means to willfully disregard. So ignorance is deliberate. In a sense, we have deliberately forgotten our cohesion in the Supreme above and undertaken to become what seems to be fractional here, what seems to be partial here. It is not true deep down, but on the superficies of existence, it's a way of explaining selfhood existence. Always in the inner being, Guhyam, that fire burns. That fire within is one with that which illuminates the cosmos, from which both cosmos and individual come. It is cognate. Sri Aurobindo continues, he is ignorant because there is upon the eyes of his soul and all its organs the seal of that nature, prakriti, maya, by which he has been put forth into manifestation out of God's eternal being. She has minted him like a coin out of the precious metal of the divine substance, but overlaid with a strong coating of the alloy of her phenomenal qualities, stamped with her own stamp and mark of animal humanity. And although the secret sign of the Godhead is there, it is at first indistinguishable and always with difficulty decipherable, not to be really discovered except by that initiation into the mystery of our own being, which distinguishes a Godward from an earthward humanity. So, if we get inside, we can know that in us which is divine. If we live outside, we live in a divided, fragmented being, and we have become lost. Lost to the greater truth. In the avatar, the divinely born man, the real substance, shines through the coating. The mark of the seal is there only for form. The vision is that of the secret Godhead. The power of the life is that of the secret Godhead, and it breaks through the seals of the assumed human nature. The sign of the Godhead, an inner soul sign, not outward, not physical, stands out legible for all who read, pardon me, for all to read, who care to see or who can see. For the Asuric nature is always blind to these things. It sees the body and not the soul, the external being and not the internal, the mask and not the person. In the ordinary human birth, the nature aspect of the universal divine assuming humanity prevails. In the incarnation, the God aspect of the same phenomenon takes its place. In the one, he allows the human nature to take possession of his partial being and to dominate it. In the other, he takes possession of his partial type of being and its nature and divinely dominates it. Not by evolution or ascent, like the ordinary man, the Gita seems to tell us, not by a growing into the divine birth, but by a direct descent into the stuff of humanity and a taking up of its molds. So we come here and we become enmeshed in the world and we find our way up. We work through a process of ascent to climb the heights and regain our sense of true self. But with the avatar, it is not an ascent, it is a descent. That's why it's called avatara. What descends? Who descends? This sentence here, this last, is chapter 4, verse 6. It insists that the divine power incarnating muscles through the nature, exerts power, and insists on imposing upon the form the essence of its self-knowledge. So we continue. But it is to assist that ascent or evolution, the descent is made or accepted, that the Gita makes very clear. It is, we might say, to exemplify the possibility of the divine manifest in the human being, so that man may see what that is and take courage to grow into it. It is also to leave the influence of that manifestation vibrating in the earth nature and the soul of that manifestation presiding over its upward endeavor. This will remind you of the section in the early words in Synthesis of Yoga where Sri Aurobindo describes the nature of the teacher. Instruction, yes, but more powerful than the instruction, the example. More powerful than the example, the influence, which abides, sets, in a sense, a standard which others can follow in years, decades, centuries, millenniums to follow. It is to give a spiritual mold of divine manhood into which the seeking soul of the human being can cast itself. Again, chapter 4, sloka 7 and 8. It is to give a dharma, a religion, not a mere creed, but a method of inner and outer living, a way, a rule and law of self-molding by which he can grow towards divinity. It is too, since this growth, this ascent, is no mere isolated and individual phenomenon, but like all in the divine world activities, a collective business, a work, and the work for the race, to assist the human march, to hold it together in its great crises, to break the forces of the downward gravitation when they grow too insistent, to uphold or restore the great dharma of the Godward law in man's nature, to prepare even, however far off, the kingdom of God, the victory of the seekers of light and perfection, sadhunam, and the overthrow of those who fight for the continuance of the evil and the darkness. The Avatar does all of this. This is exemplified in Chapter 3, Shlokas 20 through 25, which we've covered, the idea of Loka Sangraha, the holding together of the worlds of the peoples, this great duty that we have to carry light forward, to congeal all in its favor. That is the Sanatana Dharma. And you'll remember Sri Aurobindo spoke directly to that when he came out of the Alipur jail and regained his freedom and rejoined his countrymen decades prior to the physical liberation of India. He was declaring that India would be free because the divine had declared it to be so and needed India to be free so that the world as a whole could prosper. All these are recognized objects of the descent of the Avatar, and it is usually by his work that the mass of men seek to distinguish him, and for that, that they are ready to worship him. It is only the spiritual who see that this external Avatarhood is a sign in the symbol of the human life, of the eternal inner Godhead, making himself manifest in the field of their own human mentality and corporeality, so that they can grow into unity with that and be possessed by it. The divine manifestation of Christ, Krishna, Buddha in external humanity has for its inner truth the same manifestation of the eternal Avatar within in our own inner humanity. That which has been done in the outer human life of Earth may be repeated in the inner life of all human beings. So, once registered in the interior dimensions of humanity, those who rise through the force of evolution and personal aspiration can be ignited by this and also be carried upwards, becoming like God. This is the object of the incarnation. But what is the method? First, we have the rational or minimizing view of Avatarhood, which sees in it only an extraordinary manifestation of the diviner qualities, moral, intellectual, and dynamic, by which average humanity is exceeded. In this idea, there is a certain truth. The Avatar is, at the same time, the Vibhuti. Vibhuti, originally applied to Shiva, refers to that which is pervading, a manifestation of great might. This Krishna, who in his divine inner being is the Godhead in a human form, is in his outer human being the leader of his age, the great man of the Vrishnis, This is from the point of view of the nature, not of the soul. The divine manifests himself through infinite qualities of his nature, and the intensity of the manifestation is measured by their power and their achievement. The vibhuti of the divine is, therefore, impersonally, the manifest power of his quality. It is his outflowing in whatever form of knowledge, energy, love, strength, and the rest. Personally, it is the mental form and the animate being in whom this power is achieved and does its great works. This goes to 10.7 and 10.41, by the way. A preeminence in this inner and outer achievement, a greater power of divine quality, and effective energy is always the sign. The human vibhuti is the hero of the race's struggle towards divine achievement, the hero in the Carlylean sense of heroism, a power of God in man. Now that illusion will be lost to modern readers. Thomas Carlyle was a dominant person of letters in the 19th century. He wrote a book called On Heroes, and the hero represents a divine idea in his thinking, following Fichte, which gets manifest in the whole of humanity. Here's a quote. The hero is the sacred mystery of the universe, what Goethe calls the open secret, open to all, seen by almost none. That divine mystery, which lies everywhere in all beings, the divine idea of the world, that which lies at the bottom of appearances, as Fichte styles it, of which all appearance is but the vesture, the embodiment that renders it visible. This he wrote in 1841, and in some ways you can see that that presages what Sri Aurobindo is writing about here, the Carlylean sense of heroism, a power of God in man. And this next verse is chapter 10, 37. I am Vasudeva, Krishna, among the Vrishnis, says the Lord in the Gita, Dhananjaya, Arjuna, among the Pandavas, Vyasa, among the sages, the seer poet Ushanas, among the seer poets, the first in each category, the greatest of each group, the most powerfully representative of the qualities and works in which its characteristic soul power manifests itself. I don't want to get lost in this, but if you're wondering about Ushanas, he appears in the Rig Veda as a friend and consort, at least a friend, let's say, of Indra, companion of Indra. Rig Veda 9.87.3 and 9.97.7. And he's always remembered. So we don't have any of his great songs, but he's always thought of and recognized by the other younger rishis, seers, as marvelous, wonderful, uplifted, living above in the lightning with Indra. But he's so early that even the Rig Veda has none of his compositions, none of his poetry at its hand. The others I think you know already. Back to our paragraph. This heightening of the powers of the being is a very necessary step in the progress of the divine manifestation. Every great man who rises above our average level raises, by that very fact, our common humanity. He is a living assurance of our divine possibilities, a promise of the Godhead, a glow of the divine light, and a breath of the divine power. So any of these wonderful attributes which gains expression in us, whether it's the musical power of a Beethoven, or the political leadership or titanic dominating figuring of a Napoleon, of a Churchill, all of these represent a power that's manifest, borrowed in a sense from the divine, and while the possessor of that is really possessed by that power, it, as an individual, is not usually aware of the divinity within it. So Beethoven, Napoleon, do not know that they are representing a power of the divine active in the manifest universe. And yet, the avatar, who stands as a vibhuti, recognizes where the power comes from, that it is essentially his own, her own. Ah, yes. The Divine Mother may also descend, may also manifest upon the earth. That is a different tradition. That is the tantric tradition and not the Vedantic tradition. To that we may come later. It is this truth which lies behind the natural human tendency to the deification of great minds and heroic characters. It comes out clearly enough in the Indian habit of mind, which easily sees a partial ansha avatar in great saints, teachers, founders, or most significantly in the belief of Southern Vaishnavas that some of their saints were incarnations of the symbolic living weapons of Vishnu. For that is what all great spirits are, living powers and weapons of the divine in the upward march and battle, battling for light, not for dominion, not for domination. This idea is innate and inevitable in any mystic or spiritual view of life which does not draw an inexorable line between the being and nature of the divine and our human being and nature. It is the sense of the divine in humanity. But still, the vibhuti is not the avatar. Otherwise, Arjuna, Vyasa, Ushanas would be avatars as well as Krishna, even if in a less degree of the power of avatarhood. The divine quality is not enough. There must be the inner consciousness of the Lord and Self, governing the human nature by His divine presence. The heightening of the power of the qualities is part of the becoming. Bhutagrama, an ascent in the ordinary manifestation. In the avatar, there is the special manifestation, the divine birth from above. The eternal and universal Godhead descended into a form of individual humanity, Atmanam Srijami, and conscious not only behind the veil, but in the outward nature. Bhutagrama means multitude of beings, and we're going to chapter 9, shloka 8 for that, combined with the term Srijami. This idea, vashat, by force, stresses that the descent of the avatar is deliberate, intentional, and seizes and commands the nature and conduces it to its own purpose. Not only does it affect this from above, but indwelling in the form it cohabitates, it is aware of its own nature. Sri Aurobindo, in his correspondence, of course, will speak to the fact that even the descending divine person, even the Purushottama, has to put on the veil of humanity, has, in a sense, to accept the ignorance, to be able to lead the ignorant human form towards light. And so it is not the utter picture of perfection in everything that it sees, does, or says, but the essence of the awareness of what it is and where it came from is there, or dawns early. How many will be aware in their infancy? Even the avatar becomes aware of the nature, which is specially hers or his, only after a maturation process which will not shatter the human vessel in which that realization must dwell. There is an intermediary idea, a more mystical view of avatarhood, which supposes that a human soul calls down this descent into himself and is either possessed by the divine consciousness or becomes an effective reflection or channel of it. This view rests upon certain truths of spiritual experience. The divine birth in man, his ascent, is itself a growing of the human into the divine consciousness, and in its intensest culmination is a losing of the separate self in that. The soul merges its individuality in an infinite and universal being, or loses it in the heights of a transcendent being. So going from one term to the greater terms of being, it becomes one self with the self, the Brahman, the divine, or as it is sometimes more absolutely put, becomes the one self, the Brahman, the divine. The Gita itself speaks of the soul becoming the Brahman, Brahma Bhuta, and of its thereby dwelling in the Lord, in Krishna. But it does not, it must be marked, speak of it as becoming the Lord or the Purushottama, though it does declare that the Jiva himself is always Ishvara, the partial being of the Lord, Mamma Eva Anshaha. Become Brahman, Brahma Bhuta. That's 627 and 1854, if you like to note these things. And this idea about dwelling in the Lord and Krishna is at nearly the end of the Gita, chapter 18, shlokas 53 through 56. Mamma eva amshaha jiva loke. That's 54. For this greatest union, this highest becoming, is still part of the ascent. That's 15.7, by the way. Let's read a translation of that. It is an eternal portion of me that becomes the jiva in the world of living creatures and cultivates the subjective powers of prakriti, mind, and the five senses. A portion of me, undivided, but still an aspect of the Supreme, That becomes the jiva. So in the essence of each individuality stands the Supreme Person himself, or if you like to say herself. So we'll do that again. For this greatest union, this highest becoming, is still part of the ascent. While it is the divine birth to which every jiva arrives, it is not the descent of the Godhead, not avatarhood, but at most Buddhahood. According to the doctrine of the Buddhists, it is the soul awakened from its present mundane individuality into an infinite superconsciousness that need not carry with it either the inner consciousness or the characteristic action of the avatar. So Sri Aurobindo has said without saying it that Buddha is a figure of illumination but is not an avatar. I think we've reached about halfway through the chapter, and I suggest that we finish it next time we meet. And there's a section of Savitri which might be appropriate to read to you tonight. This is in Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, in Canto 6, Kingdoms and Godheads of the Greater Life. I think we'll start on page 199. Our life is a march to a victory never won. This wave of being, longing for delight, this eager turmoil of unsatisfied strengths, these long far files of forward striving hopes, lift worshiping eyes to the blue void called heaven, looking for the golden hand that never came, the advent for which all creation waits, the beautiful visage of all eternity that shall appear upon the roads of time. I'm going to begin again. I'd rather start on page 198. In the aimless mounting total of things done, existence seemed a vain necessities act, a wrestle of eternal opposites and a clasped antagonism's close-locked embrace, a play without denouement or idea, a hunger march of lives without a goal, or written on a bare blackboard of space, a futile and recurring sum of souls, a hope that failed, a light that never shone, the labor of an unaccomplished force tied to its acts in a dim eternity. There is no end, or none can yet be seen. Although defeated, life must struggle on. Always she sees a crown she cannot grasp. Her eyes are fixed beyond her fallen state. there quivers still within her breast and ours a glory that was once and is no more, or there calls to us from some unfulfilled beyond a greatness yet unreached by the halting world. In a memory behind our mortal sense, a dream persists of larger, happier air, breathing around free hearts of joy and love, forgotten by us, immortal in lost time. A ghost of bliss pursues her haunted depths, for she remembers still, though now so far, her realm of golden ease and glad desire, and the beauty and strength and happiness that were hers in the sweetness of her glowing paradise, in her kingdom of immortal ecstasy, halfway between God's silence and the abyss. This knowledge in our hidden parts we keep. Awake to a vague mystery's appeal, we meet a deep unseen reality far truer than the world's face of present truth. We are chased by a self we cannot now recall and moved by a spirit we must still become. As one who has lost the kingdom of his soul, we look back to some God phase of our birth, other than this imperfect creature here, and hope in this or a diviner world to recover yet from heaven's patient guard what by our mind's forgetfulness we miss. Our being's natural felicity, our heart's delight we have exchanged for grief, the body's thrill we bartered for mere pain, the bliss for which our mortal nature yearns, as yearns an obscure moth to blazing light. Our life is a march to a victory never won. This wave of being, longing for delight, this eager turmoil of unsatisfied strengths, these long, far files of forward striving hopes, lift worshiping eyes to the blue void called heaven, looking for the golden hand that never came, the advent for which all creation waits, the beautiful visage of eternity that shall appear upon the roads of time. Yet still to ourselves we say, rekindling faith, oh, surely one day he shall come to our cry. One day he shall create our life anew and utter the magic formula of peace and bring perfection to the scheme of things. One day he shall descend to life and earth, leaving the secrecy of the eternal doors into a world that cries to him for help and bring the truth that sets the spirit free, the joy that is the baptism of the soul, the strength that is the outstretched arm of love. One day he shall lift his beauty's dreadful veil, impose delight on the world's beating heart, and bear his secret body of light and bliss. So, namaste. Jai Ma.